I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.
Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research, development, and innovation. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our past programs at radioinvivo.net. The Borough's Welcome Fund is a Golden Voices underwriter here on WCOM and Radio In Vivo. The Borough's Welcome Fund supports excellence in science education across North Carolina. The fund believes that providing students with engaging and interactive curriculum helps to spark curiosity for careers in science, mathematics, and technology. You can learn about education grant opportunities for North Carolina schools and teachers at www.bwfund.org. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a nonprofit science center devoted to cross-disciplinary research in evolution. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, NCABR's mission has been to promote public understanding of and support for bioscience research and careers. NCABR offers many resources for both researchers and K-12 science teachers, including conferences and free professional development workshops. To learn more, visit ncabr.org. Radio In Vivo is proud to acknowledge the underwriting support of our friend Mr. Steve Brockman. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by Steve for the advancement of science and education. It's also a pleasure to acknowledge the underwriting support of Dr. Bob Kunder of Carolina Neuropsychological Service of Raleigh and Chapel Hill. Bob provides neurocognitive evaluations and neurofeedback for sports concussions and optimal sports performance. You can learn more about Carolina Neuropsychological Service at carolinacns.com. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by Chapel Hill Eye Care, located at 235 South Elliott Road in Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill Eye Care provides comprehensive eye care to people of all ages. Healthy eyes for a lifetime. Chapel Hill Eye Care, 919-968-4774. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. Since the Human Genome Project was completed in 2003, and the finished human genome sequence was made available to biomedical science, we've been waiting for genomics to live up to the grandiose promises and claims the field spawned at that point. It's not all the way there yet, but just in the past couple of years, it has advanced tremendously, and several of those promises and claims are on the verge of fulfillment as we enter the age of so-called precision medicine, also known as personalized medicine, also known as individualized therapy. Precision medicine is starting to take hold in the mainstream of clinical medical practice, led by the advent of pharmacogenomic testing, which allows analysis to predict which drugs will work in which people, at what dose, and what time. That formulation is the very essence of what personalized medicine is all about. And today, it's all but certain that that type of testing is going to become a routine part of medical care in the short-term future. For many, that future is already here, but the advent of pharmacogenomic testing raises a variety of practical challenges. And today on Radio In Vivo, we welcome a clinical pharmacist who is participating in an important research program aimed at uncovering those challenges and figuring out how best to deal with them so that pharmacogenomic testing can be fully integrated into clinical practice to the benefit of all. Jivan Modeb attended the Eshelman School of Pharmacy at UNC Chapel Hill for her pharmacy doctorate. She is currently a clinical pharmacist at the Duke University in the Center for Applied Genomics and Precision Medicine in the Department of Medicine. She works with the HAGA group, led by Dr. Suzanne HAGA, whose work focuses on implementing pharmacogenetics and pharmacogenomics into the standard of care, as well as assessing the understanding and attitudes toward the practices from both the patient's and the clinician's perspective. Jivan Modeb, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thanks for having me today.
Jivan, before we get into the specifics, if you would you give us a bit more detailed definition of pharmacogenomic and pharmacogenetic testing than I did in the introduction? I know there's a little bit more to it than what I said.
So you did a really decent job, honestly, of defining it for us.
Okay, good.
So pharmacogenomics is more of a holistic approach to things. You know, we look at anything pretty much. It's not just drugs in particular with pharmacogenomics. But when you look at pharmacogenetics, it becomes more of the focus on a patient's genetic makeup and how they break down their medications. And so that's where most of my work has been focused with the HAGA group, is looking at pharmacogenetics in particular patients and giving that precision care to patients and looking at the future of it within the standard of care.
I see. So this is really a technology and science that has really come into its own just in the recent years, isn't it? Could you kind of give us a quick thumbnail of the history of this field?
Absolutely. So actually pharmacogenetics and as a whole, we use it interchangeably, but I usually just go with pharmacogenetics, has been around since Pythagoras, honestly. It was with a fava bean. They noticed that certain people couldn't eat them and they'd have bad reactions. And so it was actually turned out that there was a chemical component there present that linked with a person's genetics that would lead to that. So as years progressed, you know, as you had stated with the Human Genome Project completing, we started to notice that, yes, there are components of liver enzymes and things like that that have a huge impact on patients' ability to break down medication. And so, and that's linked with your genetics. So the testing platforms became available as time progressed. Again, initially the tests were thousands of dollars, and now they've become fractional. You can even go to some drugstores now and be able to get particular enzyme testing for as little as $50. So we've just seen it over the past, I can tell you over the past 5 years, it started around like $500 for a particular gene, and now we're looking at $50. So exponentially beginning to decrease that. Now we can somewhat acknowledge that it could be part of standard of care.
I see. So what are the goals of pharmacogenetics? What is the field looking to accomplish?
So the goals, again, is patient outcomes. So, you know, there's so many caveats these days focused with patient care. We want to get the best outcomes, the fastest way, and this is one component of it. It's not the whole picture of it, but if a patient came in, you had a pharmacogenetic panel on them, then it gives you an opportunity to not have to do a trial and error type of approach. It lets you narrow it down quickly enough that you could pick perhaps a better dose for a patient or the right medication instead of them coming back numerous times. And so as our healthcare model keeps shifting for pay-for-performance, this could be one component of it that will reduce that issue we're having with getting people to get reimbursed. For example, if a patient repeats back into an office and with the same complaint, the reimbursement may not be there for the provider.
Sure.
So if a pharmacogenetic test is done that would maybe be able to reduce that return, then the provider's reimbursement is there, the patient's time is saved, and the outcome is reached sooner. And you've possibly reduced adverse events. And
that's a big, important part of it.
It is. I mean, in addition to cost, adverse events, patient satisfaction, all of this comes hand in hand when you're giving good care to somebody. And our goal is to make sure that when a person enters in any healthcare setting, they walk out satisfied and, I hate to say the word healed, but their complaint has been acknowledged and possibly not eradicated, but, you know, dealt with in the best way possible with the technology available.
Sure. And that's why it's referred to, particularly over the last year or so since the president's initiative, as precision medicine. Mm-hmm. It's giving that precise level of treatment fit to the individual.
Absolutely.
Right? Now, I want to return a little bit to the aspect of preventing adverse drug-related events, because that's in doing the research to speak with you today, I came across the figure that those kill or injure approximately 770,000 Americans every year in hospitals alone. Huge problem.
So with adverse events, medications is so complex, especially with disease states in particular. So it's not just solely a genetic test that will lead you to reduce an adverse event. It's, again, organ functions, other components as well. So, this is one part of the puzzle that will help reduce the adverse event component for a patient. It necessarily doesn't mean that a person wouldn't enter in again with an adverse event, but that is one component of it. It will reduce one angle of making an adverse event reduce. However, and another thing too is I think it will make a patient feel more comfortable knowing that the medication we chose for you was truly meant for you.
Mm-hmm.
And if an adverse event happens, then it could have been, you know, your body's function, but it wasn't your genetics. And so that gives a both angles, the healthcare provider and the patient, this rest assuredness of, hey, this drug's going to work. And mm-hmm. I hope it, when this
and
patient
leaves. It's not going to hurt you.
And it's not going to hurt you. And if it does hurt you, it's because of something else. It could be that, you know, again, drug interactions are always there. Even if we screen to the capacity that we can, mm-hmm. you know, the patient's, for example, organ function may be more reduced, and you may not know that at the time, because that test wasn't ran, and you'll find out that the person had an adverse event. Or a dose was given too much to a patient, which had no way of having a genetic test, and they're hospitalized for that component as well. But pharmacogenetics will give us this ability to the ones that have data available, medications that have pharmacogenetic components, to be able to truly give someone the rest assuredness of having less chance of having an adverse event.
Sure, and that's going to be so important going forward. People will have that, as you put it, rest assuredness, mm-hmm. and that'll be great. Now, the component of this testing, to a large degree, is to identify high, medium, and low metabolizers of individual drugs, which goes a long way towards predicting that drug's efficacy or danger in an individual. Could you expound on that a little
bit? Yeah, absolutely. So actually there's four things we look for. It's going to be...
I got three out of four.
Yeah, well, there you go. So you forgot normal as well. Yeah, so, and that's just as important too as we always look for the negative in things or try to find the problems with things. But the normal component's significant as well because it will lead us to be able to use the drugs for what it really is. You know, there are people that are poor metabolizers, so they might not be able to break down the drug and they may have a placebo effect going on. Or, for example, if they have a poor metabolism going on, they're not able to break down the drug, period. You know, they're able to break down some of it, but not all of it. So they'll have extra amounts remaining in their body, which could lead to the toxicity and the adverse events.
Sure. And I remember a case with a young man dying of a Valium overdose very thing.
And even with codeine as well. Mm-hmm. And so that's with a ultra rapid. But then you have patients that are intermediate. They have some type of function, but we're not sure how much function. So does the dose need to be less, more? that leaves us kind of up in the air. Mm-hmm. And again, and then it becomes another component of when you have another drug that's competing at that site, how do you address that? So sure. that becomes the other precision component of it. Mm-hmm. And then the normal person, like a normal metabolizer, makes you feel like, oh, this is like old school. We can go the way we wanted to go from the beginning. But then you have the ultra rapid metabolizers as well. And some of those individuals break down much quicker. And so, for example, with codeine, if you have an ultra rapid metabolizer, they break down the codeine component that will turn into morphine. And so then they have a toxicity of too much narcotic going in, and they could lead to adverse events as well. Not to the extreme of death, but, you know, it was mostly documented with mothers that were postpartum. And so when they're breastfeeding their children, it was going through the milk, and their infants were the ones that were having the adverse event. So, again, there are four components to drug metabolism as of right now. Now, in years to come, it might change again. As technology increases, we might find out more and more. Sure. But as of today, there's four that we like to narrow in. And each one is significant because it leads you into which way to go.
Indeed. Well, you know, I wonder about the dosing ranges of some of these very widely used drugs as well. Warfarin is the one that comes to mind that has such a narrow window of dosing, and that dosing is so mm-hmm. critical. Do these tests help determine those kind of things?
So warfarin's actually so warfarin's kind of a neat one. I call that one like mystic medicine type thing because honestly, when you do a pharmacogenetic test on warfarin, it tells you the dose, like automatically where you should be for the patient, which is very neat to have. Mm-hmm. I don't know, some of the people are listening and might be on warfarin. They know the pains of being on warfarin is that, you know, it's a trial and error component. Everyone starts at 5 milligrams, come back in a couple of days, see how it goes, and back and forth until you hit the range you're looking for. So the nice thing about that test is it really does give you an exact dose. But the one that comes most to the mind for me with dosing is Plavix or clopidogrel. Mm-hmm. That's another one that's been a very hot subject because it is in the package insert. It's a black box warning that's presented on in the FDA label. And so patients, it does guide you on how to go about this. And the guidance comes from something called a CPIC guideline. And these CPIC guidelines are compiled over data, and it's a group that effort that does this that helps guide clinicians to be able to make the judgment calls of what to do, because that information is not listed in the package insert. It doesn't tell you. Like in warfarin, however, it does. Mm-hmm. So it guides you on how to do it in the package insert for warfarin, but not in Plavix. So what do you do as a clinician? What do you do as a patient? You find out this information. Are you doing more harm than good? And so, for example, with Plavix, if you're normal, you stay at your normal dose. If you're ultra-rapid metabolizer, you stay at normal dose. But if you're poor intermediate, you have to go to something else. And the reason that happens is because Plavix is a prodrug. So it requires this enzyme, which is called CYP2C19, mm-hmm. to activate the medication to become in its active form. And so when that step's not available.
And that's the system that metabolizes
absolutely.
The drug.
And that's where you see the genetic testing coming in.
And turns it into the active component.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So you need that enzyme to do that.
Sure.
And so when that activation step isn't there, you've actually given someone possibly a placebo. Mm-hmm. And they're just taking this mm-hmm. medicine thinking that after they've gotten a stent placed that they're safe and they're good to go. And right. they could have a cardiovascular event if they're a poor metabolizer. And, you know, we did a lot of harm to a patient. We've possibly, if they come in for an event, we've, you know, damaged their heart possibly, accrued expenses that were not wanted, inconvenient the patient. What is it? And again, using healthcare dollars that shouldn't have been used if we could have just done a simple test from the beginning. So these tests have some real nice guidelines set up, and some of the guidelines are still being, you know, shaped as we speak. So as we keep moving forward and data becomes more available, we're able to give more of a narrowed dose to people and be able to guide clinicians to say, okay, well, you can use these tests because you have some guidance. Beforehand, it was, we have some tests, we got some guidance, but not a whole lot. But now the guidance is becoming much, much more precise and defined.
Well, that's good to hear that mm-hmm. that is really progressing.
It really is.
And part of the progress of the field also, Javon, I wanted to ask you about is how the advent of next-generation sequencing and the dramatic reduction of costs mm-hmm. involved in sequencing has affected the predictive quality of pharmacogenetic testing.
Sure. So again, my training is in pharmacy, so I'm not a geneticist, but my boss is. So she's very well knowledgeable on next-gen sequencing. So I hope I do some justice here.
I'm sure you will.
So with that being said, as technology keeps getting more advanced, and the chips are becoming more cheaper as, you know, as time is going forward, there's a lot of data being presented. And we actually did a study that used a DMET chip, which was, I think it was like 500 genes came on it for us. And we were particularly looking for just five, but we banked the rest for the patient for future if they, you know, we didn't put in the medical chart because a lot of the information, we didn't have anything that was applicable to it. But in years to come, we might.
Sure.
So the patient was eligible to get that information later as time progresses. But that sequence, I would say 10 years ago, would have cost us maybe like $100,000, you know. And the sequence we got was at fraction costs for it. It was very affordable. You know, it's not something that a lay person could understand because it was it came in a zip drive of all data that came in it. So those are the parts that we have to acknowledge in the future is that the data is so robust that we have to find an ability to be able to synthesize what we're looking for mm-hmm. and to be able to leave the other stuff maybe in the background and have it for just in case if we need to double check things, you know.
Sure.
But
so like everything else, bioinformatics
exactly.
is critical.
It's very important, and that's one of the components with this type of science to become part of standard of care has to have those components that I'm truly optimistic that that is going to happen in the next few years to come because that is, you know, first we got electronic medical record we got to set, and now we can expand off of that. But next-gen sequencing is really moving forward. It's becoming just a few drops of blood, and you got it.
Yeah.
Compared to
yeah.
what it was years ago where you need vials, you know?
Yeah, right.
and then, but, you know, we've done some neat things, too, with the technology that's been available. They've done the buccal swabs where you just mm-hmm. go in the mouth to just, you know, you swab the inside of the cheek.
Sure.
And we were able to get a lot of sequencing from there. We've done spit or saliva. That one was more complex because people don't have as much saliva as you think they would to offer for us to fill the vial. But we've looked at all those type of components as well because patients don't want to give blood, you know, unless they have to. So mm-hmm. The technology is moving in the direction, too, that all you have to do is just, you know, swipe in the cheek or just spit in a vial and, you know, we're good to go. So, yeah, it's really moved forward. And the costs have gone down much more. And it's something that even institutions can explore to want to even try to, you know, pilot in their like I know the University of Indiana is one of them. They're piloting to see if it's something they could, you know, feasibly do. Vanderbilt has always been a front runner. Of course, St. Jude's always, you know, but now that the sequencing is becoming so much affordable, it lets institutions to see, okay, well, maybe we could put this in our standard of care because it's not going to cost much more. And maybe we might be able to save in the long run and be able to calculate maybe a return on investment because it's hard to see that today.
Sure.
Preventative care or preemptive approaches are hard to see the return on investment.
Indeed. Well, that day is coming for sure.
Very shortly, I hope.
Javon, I wanted to ask you how this type of testing differs from the type of direct-to-consumer DNA testing our listeners have probably heard much about,
sure.
Particularly from companies like 23andMe,
yeah.
Who aggressively market to consumers mm-hmm. And whose practices in the last couple of years have kind of run afoul of the FDA from time to time. How does this differ from that type of
sure.
testing?
This is a great question. Honestly, I'm not here to promote 23andMe, but I really did enjoy their direct-to-consumer approach. I thought they gave really great information. The only thing that became a, you know, as we all know, is that when you give information like that, it is privileged information. And so if you can't direct people on what to do with this information, that's where it becomes kind of hairy, you know. As I recall, 23andMe was CLIA certified. Their lab was, as our labs are as well, that we use. Mm-hmm. So the only thing I think is a big difference here is we're the ones that receive the information before the patient, obviously, because that's direct to consumer is a little different. You know, we're more accountable to it as well. I mean, 23andMe could write a letter to them and saying, well, it's a business. Sorry, things didn't work out. Our lab had a glitch that week and we'll rerun your samples and see what happens. You know, mm-hmm. We're more... You know, we're in academic institutions where we're going with places like Mayo, Wisconsin, even other labs that are coming out. They're deemed for that type of work, and they're reporting it to us like they would, for example, a cholesterol like panel. So they're all CLIA certified, and again, the information like. Nowadays, when you go to the doctor, you get your lab work and you can actually go on your e-chart and see it before the doctor comes to tell you. But years ago, you know, you'd have to wait and the doctor would call you or you'd come back to see how your LDL looked and if you needed more medicine. And the thing is, it's somewhat similar, you know. Now it's kind of like a direct-to-consumer if you look at it. You go to get your lab work done, you get to see it before the doctor even calls you because it's now all, you know, transparent. So essentially... this is the way I see it. Direct to consumer and even our own labs are very similar. They're doing good science. I think the only difference is that you can't bill your insurance company for direct consumer because it's your choice.
Indeed.
And you want to.
And there are some companies that have actually started to commercialize pharmacogenetic and pharmacogenomic testing, right?
Right. There is a handful. I don't know if we're going into that in the next round of the call, but in the next round of this conversation. But there is a handful. Even you can go to a community pharmacy now, and you can walk up and say, "I'd like a pharmacogenetic test on my ADD panel," and they have one, and you just pay X dollars to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's available, and they're commercialized, and the pharmacy's using it as an entity to do it. Again, with our testing. You know, in-house, you know, there's a physician that's ordering this or there's an institution that's backing it as opposed to direct consumer. There isn't. It's just, you know.
Sure.
You.
Sure. There is that intervention.
Yeah, there's an intervention that there's someone accountable to it. So that's basically, I think, what's the big difference between direct to consumer and, you know, like testing in-house.
That's appropriate because, you know, in terms of determining the optimum drug and the optimum dosage, and treatment modality, you really need that expert opinion.
And the other part, too, is that maybe individuals that might have done 23andMe, they might have taken the results to their doctor, but it's not validated to the doctor.
Right.
So that's the other part, too, is you have this information, but your physician may not be welcoming it because they don't really know what 23andMe stands for. Even though if you look back to see who's behind it, they have a very good lab and they've done a very good job of having a proper lab set up. But the thing is, again, a physician or a clinician may not feel comfortable just taking something off the street. Sure. You wouldn't want to go, you know, they do these street type, you know, health clinics. If you took that, like they did a cholesterol panel for you, then they're on the, you know, with a machine, and you took it to your doctor's office. Most physicians or clinicians may not be like, okay, well, thanks for this.
Right.
But I'm going to run my own labs because I want to make sure that it's was done in the proper setting. Things are, you know, you know, legit to them, you know, before they make any decisions. And I think that's where the direct to consumer becomes a glitch for patients is because they can take the information to their physicians, but it's not, or their clinician of any sort, and it's not really accepted because it's not validated to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the kind of issue that you and your group have been doing a considerable amount of research on. And I'd like to spend kind of the rest of the program really talking about some of the specific publications your group has put out just in the last couple of years. First, tell us about the 2013 publication in the journal Therapeutic Advances in Drug Safety, which was titled Pharmacogenetic Testing, Current Evidence of Clinical Utility. That seems like a hot topic. So tell us what you were able to find in that study.
So at that time, you know, we were realizing that still very in the beginnings of it, you know, the tests were still kind of not really affordable at the time.
And this is just 2 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Things have really changed in the past few years. So, you know, there was evidence that there's good data for using it, but the uptake was limited because of, again, cost, education by a physician that, you know, they didn't feel comfortable taking on, you know, a test that they weren't sure of or certain of, or the guidelines weren't really set. So that was one of the things that we concluded was there's really great data available for particular medications, but we're still kind of pending on, you know, physician uptake, institution uptake to be able to do it. If I recall, Plavix was on there at the time on that publication.
It was.
You know, it was interesting when we were editing the paper, their guidelines had changed right when we were resubmitting, and they had actually acknowledged ultra-rapid metabolizers as getting the same dose.
Now, who sets these guidelines?
CPIC guidelines. And so CPIC guidelines is a collaborative effort. I think it's NHGRI that does it.
Okay.
They bring them together, these scientists within the country that are passionate about this type of work. I know Duke does some work with them as well. And, you know, it's basically let's look at this data. Let's look at how, you know, we have a pool of genetic tests, you know, and a lot of it comes from St. Jude's because they have so much available biobanking available there. So, you know, they see the tracks and trends of, you know, how people metabolize drugs. And then they look at, well, if this drug was X and this was the genetic test, where would we sit? And so, and that's how they decipher what doses go how. And, you know, I actually ran into one of the lead people in it not too long ago. And I told her, I was like, you need to give us doses. You just can't give us possible reduction by X percentage. People want concrete numbers.
Sure.
And so, and she was even saying that that's what they're trying to do now is to give concrete numbers because the acceptance would be more if there was a, use 25 milligrams as opposed to 50. So that's where they're heading is to try to give more concrete guidance because more data is available.
I see. Well, it was interesting in that conclusion of that paper, it was stated that a major obstacle remaining to clinical implementation was absence of data demonstrating clinical utility. So it sounds like that situation is already starting to turn around.
It's improving. And I think that's where, you know, with studies going forward and seeing the acceptances aren't there is because, you know, we don't want to harm patients. That's the bottom line. We want to give patients the best care we can. Mm-hmm. And if you know, I can say from my perspective, I don't know a dose, I don't feel comfortable saying, let's use this medicine based off of this because I want to make sure that they don't come back with the same complaint or, you know, that they have faith in their institution that they're there. So that's one of the main reasons why uptake's limited sometimes is because we want to have concrete and our sciences and our healthcare model, even any training, medical training you see, it's evidence-based.
Sure.
It's not whim science. You know, right. We want a concrete number. We want some labs that support it. Any medical book you open up, they have that. Any pharmacy book, anything in healthcare, we're evidence-based. We look at recent clinical trials to make sure that we're doing the best for our patients.
Absolutely. Well, in that same paper, also in the conclusion, you write that the use of preemptive testing may address some of the practical barriers in the integration of pharmacogenetic information to avoid delays in treatment. Mm-hmm. I was intrigued with that concept. How would that work?
So this has been another like barrier that we've had over the years is that you get a pharmacogenetic test for a patient. Well, the labs have really improved. So I'm not saying that, you know, they're horrible, but 2-3 day turnaround is great for certain labs, but they're not helpful if you're trying to start someone on warfarin, for example. You're going to start that 5 milligram dose by the time you get the results back. They've stabilized. So, and you've already gotten the dose. And I've actually tried that before to see like, will the dose match, just to see? That's why I call it mystic medicine sometimes, because it's dead on. Okay. Like, the patient would be on a 3 milligram dose and is dead on. And that was done, you know, the patient was brought back 6 weeks or something, to back and forth, till they got that optimal dose. But the test automatically told patients that they would be sitting at that. Mm-hmm. So the thing,
and warfarin, to digress a bit, is really kind of the poster child for all of this, isn't it? In that it's been so heavily studied, particularly at UNC.
Right. So, and the thing is that, but the funny thing is that, well, not funny, ironic, I guess is the right word to say. Warfarin was never really embraced after that. They realized the turnaround time was too long. So major, you know, American Heart Association, places like that, they didn't want to take it. They're saying, unless, you know, you have this panel ready to go, absolutely worthless to us for the patient to invest that type of money in that test. Mm-hmm. At that time, the test was probably running around $400. So
significant.
So mm-hmm. Think about it. If you brought the patient back and forth and you did the math, you might have saved $100 just bringing them back and forth. So, that was one of the main reasons, I think, that it wasn't, the uptake was being very limited because the tests were so expensive. And that was, years ago, Medco, do you remember?
Yeah.
They had, mm-hmm. They were actually the front runners for warfarin. They were showing the return on investment and how great it was. But, you know, with hard economic times, they got sold to Express Scripts and their labs were shut down. So all that data that they had collected, we may have been able to see more and more, but it went away. And so what Medco was doing, any person that was prescribed warfarin, they were giving the test no matter what. Even if the turnaround time was delayed, they were giving it for free.
Wow.
And so that's why they were showing how great warfarin could be with this testing. And then when they dissolved their labs, we didn't hear much about warfarin ever again, because, again, people were like, I've got to wait 2 weeks or a week to get this test result. My patient might be stable by then.
Mm-hmm.
Not worth it at the time they were doing, let's draw some blood to get the sample. Again, really not a great approach. So from that paper's conclusion, we came with, you know, it would be great if we had more education for people so they would know how to interpret tests and be able to use guidelines that were helpful. And the other part was a preemptive approach may let us have the ability to use the data we have to be able to give that, you know, precise medicine. So, yeah, maybe today you don't need warfarin. But if you did a panel, then, you know, 10 years from now, if you develop AFib and you need warfarin, then you would just go to the medical record and look and say, okay, you just get a 3 milligram dose.
Sure.
But I don't know how much longer warfarin will be on the table, because they have these new, they're called DOACs, direct anticoagulants, that are doing the trick. I think people that were on warfarin currently will stay on it. And the very elderly will, or people that are prone to falls, will go to warfarin, because the DOACs will be, they're great. You don't have any extra monitoring. You just come in, you go out. You don't have as much dietary restrictions. There's actually no dietary restrictions. So it's becoming a winning component that physicians are shifting to go there.
And they're getting a lot of advertising too.
Right. The only downfall with it is there's no reversal agent. So with warfarin, the nice thing about this drug was there was a vitamin K reversal that you could use if you had, you know, very high numbers. With a patient that goes onto these DOACs, however, if they fall or something like that, it's just going to be a transfusion if they're bleeding. So that's the only downfall. But like I said, in the future, I don't know how much more warfarin will last in this in our institutions. It might become a relic of the past. Who knows?
Indeed. Well, that's happened.
It's part of many medicines.
Part of the evolution of medicine, right?
Absolutely.
You are listening to Radio In Vivo, and my guest today is Dr. Jovan Modeb from Duke University. Jovan, that brings us around to what I believe is your most recent publication from your group, a paper called Challenges to Integrating Pharmacogenetic Testing into Medication Therapy Management. Now, I wasn't familiar with that terminology, so I'd like to get you to kind of tell us a little bit more about what is MTM, or Medication Therapy Management?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So Medication Therapy Management came about right around, it's always been done, but it really became like coined, I'd hate to say that, right around the emergence of Medicare Part D. So medication therapy management is basically taking a patient's whole entire medicine list and basically chipping at it, seeing what's duplicated, see what you can get rid of, see if something's interacting, reducing adverse events. Unfortunately, a lot of meds these days, it's like a snowball effect. I hate to say this. One medicine gives you this effect, so therefore you have to take something else. And so a lot of people have gotten to the point where even insurance companies are like, well, let's sit down and try to get rid of some of these medicines on these patients. You know, it helps with costs, it helps outcomes, it helps the patient.
Sure.
So this is where it emerged, was right around Medicare Part D, because they realized patients that are on 13 or more meds really do need some, you know, hands-on approach, especially with so many people going to so many different doctors as well. You know, one person has a cardiologist, one person has an endocrinologist, and then a family, you know, family medicine doctor. And sometimes they're prescribing on top of each other.
Right.
And if their electronic medical records aren't linked together, you really can't tell. So, so that became one of the situations. Now, we are very privileged to be in the Triangle area because, you know, we have such great healthcare. But the minute we leave maybe 50 miles outside of this area, patients don't have that access, like, you know, like we do. And so they go to their family doctors and they go to a family cardiology office and they have their own things going on. So that's where it becomes the pharmacist or even a nurse or whoever wants to do the medication therapy management becomes kind of like a liaison. And they can, you know, help, it's usually a pharmacist, help reduce those burdens for the patient and be able to contact physicians saying, hey, this med's being duplicated. You're on this one and same class and another one and the same one. Let's drop one of them. Which one do you guys want to drop? And so, you know, we bring down people's medication regimens. We make things simplify for them. If there's barriers, we address that, like pill boxes are simple things to do. But sometimes patients don't know that, you know, and so they just need a little bit of encouragement and some guidance. And, you know, you can help people increase their adherence and be able to, you know, not be visiting an ER as often. So that's where medication therapy management comes. So the next part comes is that we're like, well, you know, it'd be really cool if you had someone's pharmacogenetic panel, and then you could be able to see how their drugs are interacting with their genetics and how they're interacting with their medicines as a whole too. And if you can, you know, maybe pick a different medicine that would work, it would be effective for the patient. So we actually did a study that did that not too long ago in a cardiology clinic. That was our first paper. That was our barriers to get there.
Okay.
We are actually, it's in review right now for the end results of it. And so it was a very neat study. We picked a sicker population because we want people on medicine. So we picked a cardiology clinic at Duke where 30 patients were recruited. Most of them, I think the average was they at least had 13 drugs apiece.
Wow.
So again, they were getting phenomenal care already at their institutions. So they were, you know, not as intense as a, again, if you live 50 miles outside of North, you know, Raleigh or the Triangle area, you know, the care, not that it would fall, it's just there's so many other hands in the pot that aren't linked together in an institution, it becomes harder to keep track.
Sure.
So we did catch some of that because, you know, at Duke, a lot of patients just come for their cardiologist to Big Duke, but then they go back to their, you know, hometowns. And we caught some of that type of stuff where, you know, duplications of medicine was being done and patient had no clue. Preventing hypoglycemia was one of them. And making sure that the best outcomes were coming out for the patient. Adherence, you know, looking to see if refills are being done, things like that. Again, particular sicker patients, certain sicker patients, are more in tune with their health. So they go get refills and things like that because they realize that, you know, their alternative isn't very good.
Indeed.
And then you have other patients that are like, oh, this is a sham. I'm not really sick, right. You know, and they don't really listen and their adherence goes down. So, you know, we worked with those patients. You know, I was an interventionist on that study. It was a very neat study to be part of. We did a DMET chip on them. We got all their genetics at that point to see what, but we didn't disclose all of it. We just looked at the five enzymatic steps of their medication pathways. And again, as time progresses, these enzymes, there will be more enzymes. but as of right now, there are only five big ones.
Mm-hmm. And the reason, and all part of the cytochrome P450s.
And there are other cytochrome P450s that mm-hmm. we do collect the data for.
And this is where drugs are metabolized.
Absolutely.
And become active.
That's correct. Or they're transporters even. There's some transporters okay. in there too. Like mm-hmm. A neat one that we looked at was simvastatin, a typical cholesterol medicine. Mm-hmm. There's a transporter, SLCO1B1, that if it's a faulty transporter, it backs up the drug. And so you're not able to, that's where those muscle aches come for some people. And so that side mm-hmm. effect component. So very neat test that tells you that. If you're on simvastatin. However, the other statins don't use that transporter. So, you know, when they were developing their drugs. So that's one of the things with medication therapy management that we did. We looked at drug metabolism based off of genetics, drug-drug interactions, and duplications of care, reduction of adverse events, and being able to maximize, you know, patient reductions of like tablets and things like that. If there's a, you know, a combination product, let's use a combination product. So instead of taking two tablets, you know,
sure.
Reducing pill burdens. And again, most important thing is patient satisfaction. Mm-hmm. You want mm-hmm. them to come in and appreciate the healthcare they're getting because there's a value attached to that. If they feel like they're coming in for nothing, they're not going to take good care of themselves. So, and positive outcomes. That was our primary, you know, one of our primary goals on that. So, again, there are barriers, of course. How do you integrate this into an electronic medical record? How do you keep track of all this information as time progresses? And again, that has to go hand in hand with electronic medical record.
I see.
So mm-hmm. There has sure. to have to be some clinical decision support that has to be embedded into software systems. Still not there yet. We're still working to get all that. It's not hard to program, but again, you have to have the data there to be able to have the evidence to be able to to make that decision support. Sure. It's just like drug interactions. When you go to the hospital or even to a pharmacy, these things pop up on the screen now for the pharmacist, for the physician. But the thing is, because we know this information and it's embedded in because evidence-based. But mm-hmm. right now we're still working on what evidence to bring in and how to be able to link that genetic test with the clinical decision support, and then the evidence you want to embed into that clinical decision support.
I see. Well, Joanna, before we lose the point, I want to kind sure. of circle back and ask you a little bit in terms of the medication therapy management. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it's one more step in an increasingly important role in healthcare in general sure. of the pharmacist, and you being a PharmD and a clinical pharmacist.
Yeah.
I wanted to get you to expound on that a bit.
Sure. So as, you know, my profession has really evolved over the past decade, I can tell you. Mm-hmm. We have been able to really try to, instead of going in that dispensing role, to transition into something that we've been trained to do while, you know, we were in school for not just counting pills. We were trained for other things about, again, patient outcomes. So medication therapy management is just one of the caveats of what a pharmacist can do.
And this was known as I recall, pharmacy care.
Pharmacy care, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's just been, like I said, it was coined into medication therapy management. We were already doing it right. Beforehand. But now it's just more of a comprehensive approach. You know, pharmacists are always available to counsel patients. That being uptake by patients is up to them. And so that's the thing. It's always offered. We're always there. The sad thing is that people don't take it from us, you know, or maybe they don't realize that that's what we're trained to do. And that could have been it too. So I think that the image of the pharmacist is changing as we're not here to count pills. We're here to teach you about your medicine. We're here to reduce adverse events, be able to provide you services like immunizations, being able to guide you in that too. You know, a lot of physicians' offices are, or better yet, patients can't make it to a physician office. You know, we're one of the other entities that they can go to that they can get vaccinated. Another part that pharmacists are transitioning to is provider status. We believe that, you know, there are services that we offer that, you know, we could do more with if we had more of a, not power, but more of a privilege granted to us to be able to expand on that. And we can't do that without provider status. nurse practitioners have the ability to do it. PAs do as well. And some of the work that they're doing is very similar to pharmacy type things. And so just being able to gain a provider status, you might be able to, for example, if you have an arrangement with a physician's office or even a medical institution like a Duke or something like that, you know, be able to adjust. For example, a patient comes in having an adverse event to a blood pressure medicine or they need some intensification, with a provider status, you'd be able to do that. And it wouldn't be as much, you know, and again, it'd be documented. Everything would, you know, there'd be policies and procedures to go through. You just don't do it willy-nilly. But that's where we're heading as a profession. We want to be able to do more for a patient. We don't want to just dispense drugs to them. We want to be able to make a bigger impact and to help the medical model as a whole. That, because the big thing is here too is that there's only so much a doctor can do, and there's so much a PA can do, and there's so much knowledge that we have that we can offer with medicines. Years ago, when people would go to the physician or the doctor's office, you know, surgeries and things like that were, boom, we're going to surgery. You need open heart surgery. But now, for example, there's so many options available. Let's try these medicines first before we need to go into the invasive approach.
Sure.
And so, you know, the profession's really evolved with the development of so many new drugs.
And it seems like the implementation of pharmacogenetic testing, it seems like that's where the rubber is ultimately going to meet the road.
And we hope that, you know, pharmacy will be the place where pharmacists can take on this new role to help the medical team with being able to interpret the test, being able to help with dosing with the test, mm-hmm. and be able to help educate the patient as well. You know, historically, counseling has always been looked at as very poor on a pharmacist's end. But I think the part there is that we're there, we're not being utilized. And so I think with an MTM session, where we integrated that pharmacogenetics, there was an education component embedded in there to teach the patient about pharmacogenetics.
Okay.
And so that could be a place where you could put it to be able to get pharmacogenetics to go through with the patient to understand, because giving someone a test and handing them some jibber-jabber doesn't mean a whole lot. They have right. to be able to understand what it means to them. So if they are in a situation where they're not at their institution, or their institution isn't having the electronic medical record visual to everybody, then they can be able to be like, oh yeah, by the way, I got this test done at Duke or UNC or wherever, at my doctor's office, and this is what it stated. I want you guys to have it so you guys can choose the best medicines for me. And that's our ultimate goal, is to be able to help educate the patient too.
Yes, and one of the major issues, which you touched on briefly and I'd like to get you to expound on in a little more detail, is patient adherence. And that's something I know that you and your group have
sure.
run some studies on. Huge issue, and non-adherence has been estimated to cost the U.S. economy $300 billion a year, with a third to a half of all patients not taking their medications as directed by their healthcare providers. So what have you found that pharmacogenetic testing can bring to the table in terms of improving that picture?
So a lot of patients will say, well, I don't see the effect or the benefit of this medicine, so I don't see the point, take it, which is a valid statement. You know,
sure.
we like to see outcomes, like in our own visual eye. You know, the only one that I could think of with medicine that's really like you could tell is, like, I hate to bring the cholesterol up, but that's the only thing you can really see, because it's a true tangible number. Your LDL is this, your HDL is this. So I think pharmacogenetics, what it can do, and I'll even use the example of the cholesterol one. If the patient's on simvastatin, they keep complaining about muscle aches. And it might be a psychological thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, because, you know, a typical person that has cholesterol issues is in their 50s. I mean, aches and pains come for everybody, you know? And so they say, it's that medicine, and they stop taking it. So this test will tell them, hey, no, no. It's not this medicine. It's just your aches and pains. It's arthritic pain. It's, you know, this humid weather, you know?
Sure.
Or instead of saying, what is it? Oh, yeah, it's the cholesterol medicine. Let's just change it. You know, so that's one nice thing about this test. It just does some justification. The other one is too, well, like, for example, with Plavix. Well, if you're a poor metabolizer, you come tell the patient, well, this has been a placebo in you, and here is this medicine that's going to work without having any, you're going to have the effects. You're not going to have, you know, cardiovascular events. Or better yet, you're a normal metabolizer, and we're certain this medicine is going to keep you from having an event. And so that's what the other part too. It gives some reassurance. So I think it might make people want to be more adherent if they know the medicine's working. Because again, when you can't see something, you just have to believe. And some people don't want to believe when it's not physically in their vision.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one component to be able to justify, well, the medicine does work, and maybe you should continue taking it.
Do you think eventually that the general public will, and patients in particular, will start to, you know, the news will start to spread and they'll start hearing about these types of tests and will start asking for them?
So I think we did see with direct-to-consumer approach with 23andMe, there was a handful of people that went and paid the $99 and was interested. So, I mean, it's mm-hmm. pretty evident that people do want these tests. Now, for patients that are, and again, with the direct-to-consumer component, we saw these people were not the average person. They were educated. They had that, you know, maybe younger. So
the
I think
early adopter.
Yeah, exactly. And so where it becomes interesting will be is where we'll see the older population that, again, patient understanding and, you know, medical literacy is a huge issue. Doesn't matter how educated you are. You can have a PhD in math, but you may know nothing about healthcare, and so, or your health in general. And so that's where it's going to become an issue, I think, in the future, is the health literacy. If it becomes more and more evident, like you walk into the drugstore and it becomes a standard that people are offering this to you, it might become natural to you to do. Or if you go to the doctor's office and it becomes, people might inquire. But if you're, the uptake might become limited if it's not in the eye. But I guess I can give you a neat analogy. I was watching television, and I guess you guys can judge me. It's okay.
That's
I was
okay.
watching Grey's Anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually had a genomic lab that they were using to be able to solve some child's illness, okay?
Right.
And so
I saw that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, you saw that one. So the thing is that these shows, I think, will reach people more than I think the news yeah. or any type of healthcare institution. So mm-hmm. when millions of people turn in to watch television, if they have that type of ability to see, then they might ask about these type of tests. Like, I was watching Grey's Anatomy and I saw this. So is mm-hmm. there something, anything truth to that, or was it just a TV show? So I think that's where we might see more people going towards that direction.
Well, it'll be interesting to keep an eye on all that. And Javon, our time together has just flown by.
Yeah.
So please keep up the good work. Give Dr. Haga my best. And thanks so much for being my guest today on Radio en Vivo.
Thanks for having me.
We've got some great guests lined up here in the coming weeks here on Radio en Vivo. You can check the website, radioenvivo.net, or our Facebook site for our lineup of upcoming shows. Join us again next time for Radio en Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you next time.